Columbia Broadcasting System and its affiliated stations present Orson Welles and the Mercury Theater on the air in The War of the Worlds by H.G. Wells.
We are recording this as we are in the midst of a global pandemic. It's unlike anything I've ever seen in my lifetime. And I know a lot of people out there are struggling. It hasn't been easy for me or those who I know. And now that we're in a few weeks of isolation, it's really starting to affect people. So I initially started this hashtag Mormon Pandemic Watch on Facebook. The idea was to sort of follow and see how different Mormons were responding to the pandemic, especially since a lot of Mormons are a prepared people. They prepare for the end times, and this does certainly feel a little apocalyptic. So I started this hashtag to see how different Mormons in the restoration spectrum are responding to this, and it's turned into this fascinating look at the pandemic. And so now people are sending me new material each day, and it's really interesting to watch, but a disturbing trend coming from my more rural, libertarian-minded Mormon friends is one where people are using the fear and anxiety that we're all feeling. You know, I fundamentally believe we're all feeling pressure from this, and it's coming out in all different ways. Some are in denial. That's a stage of grief. Some are in, mourning and depression. That's also a stage of grief. We're all dealing with this differently. But some of these folks are really letting their fear and anxiety turn into paranoia. I don't know if you've seen it yet, but there are conspiracies that the lockdown and the social distancing measures that we're taking to keep ourselves safe are the U.S. government trying to slowly take over our rights. This thinking has led LDS people like Ammon Bundy, the Bundy family, who is known for taking over the wildlife refuge in Oregon. Ammon Bundy in Idaho is organizing a Liberty Rebellion for Easter. The idea is he's going to get together like-minded, liberty-loving people to gather together and ignore social distancing rules to show that they can't be restricted by government rule. A lot of Mormon folks are feeling similarly. I'm getting a lot of reports that they're holding family parties, and there was a group that went to a restaurant outside, a Jim's family restaurant, and set up tents to eat in a group to prove that they can't be told what to do. Now, of course, I see this as a symptom of grief. Denial is a way for people to sort of maintain some power in a changing world. But as I'm watching this, and this is happening more and more, it's got me thinking about this series we're doing. It's sort of an interesting behavior to imagine what we're doing living in a post-apocalyptic scenario. As we are dealing with something really scary and new, and there are new restrictions and our patterns of behavior are changing, people are responding differently. So what would we do if it truly was post-apocalyptic? You know, like a Walking Dead scenario, the zombie movie where all of us now, every man for himself. What does that look like? Because Mormons are certainly thinking about this. Some are certainly preparing for this. What would that world look like? How do you survive? Now, I'm not saying the pandemic is anywhere near that, but it does give us an opportunity to ask some interesting questions. How would we distribute resources, food, shelter, safety? How do we figure out who is in charge? That's the most interesting idea for me, especially in context of extra legal justice. If everything is topsy-turvy, who's calling the shots? The old order of things, the old governments and systems, are a memory. And we remember that they worked well enough, but things are different now. They seem wilder, harder, resources are more scarce, passions mean something. Passions can be dangerous, especially when you have weapons involved, which is why I would invite my Mormon friends to lay down their weapons as we all get through this together. But people don't always cooperate, so how do you control law and order?
He's a criminal prosecutor and Mormon historian. She's podcaster and executive director of Sunstone. Join Lindsay Hansen Park and John Dinger for Mormon History, Crime, and Punishment Stories. This is Season 1.
same incredible terror that's menacing me will strike at you!
Come from another world, spawned in the light years of space, unleashed to take over the bodies and souls of the people of our planet, bringing a new dimension in terror to the giant super scope screen. A cursed, dreadful, malevolent thing was happening to those he loved.
Suddenly, while you're asleep, they'll absorb your minds, your memories.
I don't want any part of it.
You're forgetting something, Miles.
What's that?
You have no choice.
From city to city, an incredible, hysterical panic spreads. As the unimaginable becomes real, the impossible becomes true.
Stop and listen! Stop and listen to me! Listen! Listen! Listen to me! They're not human! Can't you see? Everyone! They're here already! You're next!
So here's the thing, Lindsay. We're talking about this post-apocalyptic scenario of Law and Order, some real Walking Dead scenario, right? To understand how humans would behave in this scenario, we don't really have to do this. We don't have to imagine and look into the future because we have history to show how it's been done.
Right, okay, but what exactly does that mean?
The Wild Wild West, as they say. You don't need to imagine this post-apocalyptic world because we have the Wild Wild West. We have a time when extra-legal practices ruled the day. We have documentary evidence to show us how people behaved.
Okay, so I get what you're saying. So to understand these questions of how people act in a world that's topsy-turvy, you're saying that we already have the wild world scenario, a scenario with passions and scarcity and power and control.
You said it right. We have frontier Mormon Utah.
Okay. I like questions that explore the human condition, the ways humans act when they are under pressure and stress, especially as we're going through this pandemic right now. It's a really stressful time, so I don't mean this episode to stress us out even more, but it makes me wonder, what do people do for justice when everything is kind of disorganized?
Right, and you need to look no further than extra-legal cases in Mormonism.
This is proving to be more timely than I thought, Dinger. I really love the idea of Mormon behavior as some sort of microcosm for larger human behavior.
Because it totally is, right? I mean, Mormons are human. They act in human ways.
Right. And people say that all the time. When I say, like, this is a Mormon thing, they're like, no, that's a human thing. And I'm like, right, but we do things through a Mormon lens. We do it in a Mormon way. So we can look at human behavior through a sort of Mormon filter. So yeah, I'm curious as to how these things play out in a Mormon way, how these struggles of scarcity and fear and power and control, how Mormons respond to that.
Exactly, and it's no different with cases of revenge and justice. Mormons on the frontier didn't just resort to extra legal justice, they depended on it.
They depended on it. Okay, well, let's get into that. What stories can we tell to illustrate this point?
We have a million stories to tell, but why don't we start with Parley P. Pratt?
Oh, I love this story. His murder, right?
Uh-huh.
Okay, this is one of the best stories in Mormonism. I know I sound like a freak saying Parley P. Pratt's murder, but it really is one of the best stories in Mormonism.
All right, so we are lucky enough to have on the podcast with us today, Joe Geisner. Joe, you're kind of a podcasting pro, but could you tell us a little bit about yourself and some exciting news that you have?
This is actually quite fun, John, because you and I have been friends for a long time. People who know me, I'm a book nerd, and I absolutely love books. They're very important to me, and I am lucky enough to have a book coming out. It is a book that has 15 chapters from 15 different authors. They're basically a who's who of Mormon writing. But that's basically what it is I asked each author to tell their story about writing their book.
Yeah, your book sounds so fascinating. For example, is one of the chapters, isn't it, Todd Compton, talking about the writing of In Sacred Loneliness?
That is correct.
And that to me is fascinating because, you know, a lot of these books were written kind of pre-internet, where it was so easy to just look up a source. I mean, I'm so excited to hear, you know, his example or Will Bagley's or many of the other authors, how they wrote the books that they did. I'm intrigued. I can't wait. Joe, can you tell us just briefly, who is Parley P. Pratt?
Yeah, Pratt, he's one of my favorite people from the Mormon past. If you have ever read any of Peter Crawley's work, he thinks that Parley Pratt basically walked on water, and I think that Peter Crawley walks on water. So he said that Pratt produced the most important of all non-canonical Mormon books, The Voice of Warning. And in many ways, particularly for the early church, it was probably more widely known and more widely read than the Book of Mormon itself. And it may have been something that, it's hard to know the chicken or the egg, but it may have even influenced Joseph Smith's development of theology. So it's a pretty big deal. His Key to Science of Theology may be a better known book in today's world, and it is also extremely important. Pratt was many of the first. He wrote the first fiction book. It's called A Dialogue Between Joseph Smith and the Devil and An Angel of the Prairie. He was a poet, so he did many of the hymns that were at least in the hymn book that I grew up in, or grew up with, not in, grew up with. He was a publisher. He was a newspaper man. He was an adventurer. And he was the one who explored the south of the Great Salt Lake. He took the expedition and made maps. Pratt was a religious primitivist, so he was wanting to find a church that was based on the original apostles and Jesus' life of the New Testament. This is where he met Sidney Rigdon in a search for that, and it actually is Pratt who brought Sidney Rigdon into the fold of Mormonism under Joseph Smith, and basically the rest is history on that.
Pratt was a member of the 12 apostles. And is it fair to say that he was sort of beloved by the people? They really liked him.
You know, that's an interesting question. I think you would say he was, for the most part. And what we'll get talking about is he did have some issues, though, with people who seemed to be really close to him, whether it was family or leadership. So Pratt and Parley Pratt, because there is the also famous brother, the younger brother, Orson Pratt, that people know. Mm-hmm. But that is actually one of the people that he had conflicts with. But Parley Pratt had a charisma that was probably below Sidney Rigdon's and Joseph Smith's. And I get the feeling that Brigham Young was probably jealous of that. But as Peter Crawley points out, Pratt was the only person allowed to publish and not get reprimanded for it. And editions of the Voice of Warning came out along with different pamphlets, that because Parley Pratt was really the father of Mormon pamphleteering. He didn't receive the condemnation over the pulpit or in private that other people did from Brigham Young.
Interesting.
So he was loved and like, and also could be really disliked, you know.
Interesting. So you mentioned a word there, the word charisma. And in my reading of church history, charisma often leads to multiple wives. And so what do we know about Parley P. Pratt's polygamous life?
Yeah, Pratt was married to 12 women. And that was, you know, not a lot of time for him to do that, because he didn't marry his first wife, Thankful Halsey, until 1829. She was unhealthy, I guess is the best way of put it. And then the stress of having a husband like Parley Pratt, who was always on the move, who was either running from the law, and that's an important point that I wanted to bring up with Pratt, that Pratt was not unacquainted with being arrested. There was a warrant out for his arrest when he went back to Ohio on one of his moves back. And it was because he had left unpaid debts. He was arrested in Missouri for murdering a person, and he did murder the person, though he did escape from jail. He was in Columbia, Missouri, when he did that. And the people of Columbia were much different than those people in Jackson County and what the conditions that Joseph Smith and Sidney Rigdon and Hiram Smith had to be in their jails. Pratt, actually, they were taken to a 4th of July picnic in Columbia, and that's where Pratt and some of the other Mormons escaped, because they had nothing, you know, there was nothing confining them. And they were actually participating in a leg race, and Pratt and the other Mormons took off in their leg race and never came back, getting back to his marital situation. So 10 of those women that he married were polygamous marriages. Pratt was prolific in propagation. Pratt fathered 30 children, 23 of those who lived to adulthood. Now, that's quite different than some of the other early people that we know of Mormonism. In May 1854, Heber Kimball prophesied that Pratt would have a posterity as numerous as the stars of heaven. From those 33 children, Pratt would then have 266 grandchildren with an estimated 30 to 50,000 descendants today. In comparison, Joseph and Emma Smith have about 1,100 living descendants today.
Okay.
So that just sort of gives you an idea that you know, Pratt has 30 to 50,000. Joseph and Emma Smith have 1,100.
So you said he had 12 wives. I want to focus in on the 12th one. Who was that?
The woman that you want to talk about is Eleanor Jane or Macomb McLean. Her maiden name was Macomb. She married Hector McLean and then left him. And she had two children, a boy and a girl, and married Parley Pratt. And they married on November 4th, 1855. Now, we were talking a little bit about those fun times of Orson Pratt and Parley Pratt and all of that. So after all that occurred, oh, and by the way, Orson Pratt and Orson Hyde also got into it in England over much the same thing. Parley Pratt was, he brought Belinda Marden with him to England. Again, polygamous wife, so nobody thinks they're married. And most of the Mormons in England didn't know about polygamy because this is 1846. And Pratt's going around telling, hey, you know, if you don't like your husband, he's telling the sisters this, if you don't like your husband, you don't think he's really good enough for him, you can always marry up. You can leave him and always marry up. Or Orson Hyde gets wind of it and throws a fit and starts accusing Parley Pratt of his membership. They have a big blow up, a huge blow up. And the letters are quite interesting. So after that blow up, all of those things blow up, and Pratt's now back, you know, getting ready to move his family west. So from 1847 to 1849, he's a very busy man. He has 10 children from those wives in that 2-year period. He also likes to keep secret. He's actually telling his wives to not tell each other that he's married to them and to not tell their own family members. So there's a lot going on in that. The last thing before we really jump in, because I think it's important, and this, I believe, and there's evidence for it, is that this is Lorenzo Dow Stevens. Now, he's writing this in 1916. And it's about him meeting Pratt and one of his wives in San Jose area, San Jose, California. Now, Stevens gets a few things wrong. He gets maiden name wrong. He says that he believes that Parley Pratt had come back from an Australia mission. He'd actually come back from his English mission. He had Elizabeth Brotherton was already there to meet him when he got to San Jose. And remember, Parley Pratt's in charge of San Francisco mission now, and he is the publisher of the Western Standard, which George Q. Cannon takes over after Pratt goes back to Utah for a short time. So this is what Lorenzo Dow Stevens writes about Parley Pratt. He said, Parley P. Pratt came there, meaning San Jose, from Australia with a young woman that he said was a spiritual wife. Now, this is Elizabeth Brotherton he's talking about. Well, mm-hmm. She had spirit enough for two as far as spirits go. When we were all called in for dinner into the dining room, there was Pratt with his wife on his lap and she combing his whiskers with her fingers. I thought it took some spirit to do that right before us all. But it may have been an evil spirit. Okay, so now let's turn to Eleanor McCombs McLean Pratt.
Well, so what do we know about her and her husband, Hector?
Yeah, all this pretty much comes from Parley Pratt wrote a defense for her, and we'll get into why that occurred. But he wrote a defense for her, and she claimed that Hector was abusive and an alcoholic. There's some issues with that. I remember reading that none of the people, and we've got Louisa Barnes Pratt's fantastic diary available to us, and there's no sense of any marital troubles like that. Now, obviously, people can keep that quiet, and there's no doubt. But if I remember right, it's been a while since I've read those journals, but I'm pretty sure that those Pratts, and again, I don't believe they're closely related with Parley Pratt and Orson Pratt. I believe they're either in the same building or even on like the same floor next door to one another in the little apartment complex. And back then, San Francisco apartments were not the nice, beautiful, multi-billion dollar apartments they are today. They were basically, you know, thin walls, and because San Francisco never gets super cold because of the ocean and bay, and it never gets super hot. So either, you know, you have a fireplace and you shut your windows, or you have no fireplace going and you open your windows, you know. So, but people, you know, it would have been pretty easy for Louisa Pratt to have written something about it. And there's none of that. So how much stock do we put in? You know, as our yours and my friend Mike Marquardt likes to say, you and I weren't there. So it's sort of hard to really know what occurred, but that was the claim. And she had two children with Hector. She joined the church in San Francisco. Hector was not enthusiastic about it. And she claims that for marital bliss, that she stopped talking about Mormonism and stopped attending Mormonism. And then she sang a hymn to the two children, the little boy, little girl, and that Hector threw a fit, attacked her, and threw her out in the middle of the night. She took off and went to Utah, and probably through a lot of the Mormons. Because remember, San Francisco, the major white population that settled San Francisco was Mormon on the ship Brooklyn. San Francisco really was a Mormon town up until the gold rush that Sam Brannan advertised. The Mormon Battalion actually helped with Marshall finding. She heads to Utah and meets up with Pratt. They leave, and this is an interesting date, John. What does September 11th, 1856, when you hear that date, what's the first thing that jumps into your head?
The Mountain Meadow Massacre.
1 year later to the day. Isn't that weird?
It is.
I actually didn't realize that until I was doing research for the podcast. I think I'd known it, but it didn't jump out at me, but this time it really did jump out. So Pratt and Eleanor McLean, they leave Salt Lake City on September 11th, 1856 with a wagon train that's now heading to probably winter quarters somewhere in there to meet up, because they actually see handcart pioneers as they're heading east. The handcart pioneers, the first group of them in 1856, are coming to Salt Lake. So they see those people, and they must have been pretty close, because those first couple of handcart companies came in like in September, I think. So it would have been pretty the end of September, I think. So they would have been pretty close to Great Salt Lake. This was a mission trip for Pratt. So Pratt was going to go visit all the missions, help them with their printing and publishing, but not actually take any responsibility. He was then supposed to come back to the Great Basin. There's a traveler that Coombs, C-O-O-M-B-S, traveled with them. And I'm getting most of this information now out of Givens and Grow. That book, John Turner and I both reviewed it. And John's review was published in Dialogue, and mine was in John Whitmer Historical Journal. And we both praised this book. We both thought it was an excellent book. As a matter of fact, it actually won Best Biography for John Whitmer that year, too.
Okay.
So, but this Coombs, he makes this comment that I thought was pretty interesting. He praised his interactions with Parley Pratt, but he said of Eleanor McLean, he said that some of the company, and they were pretty down on food. They actually were pretty hungry at the time. So even those going east in a company like this, you know, had problems with shortage of food, let alone the poor handcart people. And so they killed 7 wild turkeys, so they had fresh meat. And Parley Pratt, being the one of the members of the 12 apostles, he probably was high person on the totem pole, so he gets the pick. And Coombs because he's helping along, is at the short end and he doesn't, or the low end, and he doesn't really get anything. So Eleanor, out of, as he puts it, out of the kindness of her heart, gives him spoiled elk meat that she had had hidden the entire trip so they couldn't eat it along the trip. And he said that that those who are righteous will get their reward. So he was, as at the end of his statement. So he was not impressed by Eleanor McLean Pratt. They left the main group and went straight to St. Louis, where they meet George A. Smith and Erastus Snow. Now, I believe Erastus Snow was head of the mission, and George A. Smith ends up being Pratt's travel companion as they both travel for, they hit all the missions and end up in New York City and then work their way back to St. Louis. So there's some really interesting letters that I'm just going to, you know, I know that some people don't like reading of letters, but these are so good that I think we need to take the time and journal entries to read them. So Erastus Snow and writes to Brigham Young. This is on the 14th of March, 1857. Now, this is after Smith and Pratt do their New York. They're all their Eastern and help. John Taylor's in New York, so they discuss stuff and, you know, they go through all that. And then they make it back to St. Louis in February 22nd, 1857. Oh, and Eleanor McLean says that Parley Pratt was shown the greatest respect, that he could, you know, he could take her around to all the different Mormons that were there in St. Louis and be wined and dined in these members' homes there. And so, which would make sense, you know, that, that that would occur. And so she was, she got to participate in that. Pratt, now he's there from the 22nd of February, and then things start occurring. One is that Eleanor McLean borrowed $100 from Erastus Snow and took off for New Orleans. Now, when Hector McLean threw her out that night, she left without her children and went. And that's also controversial. Some people say he threw her out. Some people say she was going after Parley Pratt. So, you know, again, we weren't there, you know. Could be either way, but she doesn't have her children. And she now is married to Parley Pratt and she wants her children back. And there's evidence in a letter that Brigham Young, and this one's April 25th, 1857. So a little over a month from this first letter I'll read, that's a Snow to Young letter again. But in that one, it's clear that Brigham Young knows what's going on and why Eleanor McLean went to New Orleans was to kidnap her children and bring them back to Utah. That was the whole purpose of her borrowing that $100. And McLean, after he left San Francisco, he sent the two kids to her parents. These are not his parents. These are not his family. These are Eleanor McLean's family. And that's where she's from. And so she goes there on the express purpose to kidnap. And how she does it is she tells her parents that she's abandoned Mormonism. She no longer believes. There's a big fight. She's done with Mormonism. And that she wants this one day, she wants to take the kids out for shopping for new clothes. I guess Hector McLean had left money there for this. And so she takes them out to shop, but she leaves town. She leaves New Orleans and starts heading west into Texas to escape her family, her parents, and her extended family, and to head to Utah, and ultimately on the trail somewhere meet up with Pratt. Now they had really not been super clear on where they were going to meet up, but they just figured that between her getting with a Mormon group and heading west from Texas, and he's heading from St. Louis and going to be heading to Utah west, and that they would meet up along the trail. There were letters, and somehow McLean, I can't remember exactly how, but McLean got these letters and realized that she had married Parley Pratt. And he knew Parley Pratt because Parley Pratt was the main leader of Mormonism in San Francisco when the McLean family, well, when she converted, and then when she left San Francisco. So that's what she does. So she kidnaps her children, starts heading west into Texas. Erastus Snow writes Brigham Young, so McLean knows now what's going on. So he's looking all over St. Louis, and he's got his buddies looking all over St. Louis for Harley Pratt. Elder George A. Smith is now with me and in tolerable health. Elder Parley P. Pratt spent one Sabbath with us since he returned from the East, but he has had to flee for his life and hide away from his enemies, who are hunting him as bloodhounds would a hare. So they're writing in code, and the April 25th letter is even more in code. But this is in code saying, you know, that McLean is out and he's the bloodhound out looking for the hare. A story was published in the newspapers about a woman, and they don't ever mention Eleanor McLean nor Parley Pratt's name in any of the news stories, about a woman stealing away her children from New Orleans to take them among the Mormons. And it is said that her husband is searching for them in this city, meaning St. Louis, and blames Elder Pratt in some way about the matter. Again, all code, you know, don't mention that they're actually married. And that he has the sympathies of the mayor, police, and the apostates of this city who contribute their aid in searching the saints' houses and keeping up a general watch. We trust in God, however, that their prey will rest secure from their grasp. So that's Erastus Snow's letter. Here's George A. Smith's letter, same day. There's an unusual bitter state of feeling against us through the state. The people are full of hatred, and they believe every lie that is published concerning us. Elder Parley P. Pratt has been hunted by the police of this city for some time. Every house that he stopped at in the city has been searched, and every apostate is on the alert for his arrest to secure a reward for his apprehension. I have not heard from him for nearly 2 weeks. The last message I received from him was that I should not feel uneasy concerning him if I did not hear from him in a year, and pray for his preservation. It is said that he will be charged with adultery, and that two women in this city will swear that he introduced a certain California gentleman's wife as Mrs. Pratt. I have been watched at every corner of the street for the last 2 weeks. Myself and friends and others have been questioned to know if I was not Mr. Pratt, which is sort of funny because George A. Smith was a pretty good-sized guy.
Yes.
and they thought that Parley Pratt, and anyway. It is probable that all this is a mere ruse to renew the old Missouri persecution on him. He preached in the church 2 weeks ago today. After meeting, he said he felt there was a person in the church who wished to kill him. There is a general excitement against him in the country. His mules and carriages are also watched. This excitement is said to grow out of the disappearance of some children from their keepers in charge of a half-frantic mother, and whose father is searching St. Louis to find them. Again, it's just fascinating. And that letter that I was alluding to about Pratt and between Erastus Snow and Brigham Young, you know, where it's clear that Brigham Young knows exactly what is going on. They all know, but they're very careful, which is also funny to you and me, because they were, as Terrell Givens and Matt Gross say in their biography, that they writing in code because they were worried that people would read their mail. And we know that the Mormons were reading the outgoing mail from the Gentiles that was going east to family or to California. So sort of funny.
Paranoid because they were doing it themselves.
Yeah, it's sort of funny how that all seems to work out. So.
And so did Hector eventually find Pratt?
Yes, that is correct. It's so complicated that I really felt that I should just take the time and read what goes on. So we talked about that Eleanor is heading to Texas. Parley Pratt, over the next couple of months, he as well starts heading to Texas. Parley Pratt does send a letter, but it taken and given to Hector McLean. In this particular way, he sort of has an idea of what area they're in because of the publicity of Eleanor McLean kidnapping her children. And so now the U.S. Marshals are now looking. So Pratt makes it to Indian Territory in Oklahoma. He is able to stay with a missionary to the Indians along with this family that are living in a very secluded area. Now, what's interesting also about that is that they had no idea who Pratt was and actually thought that Pratt was a government Indian inspector, because the Mormons would illegally go in and preach to the Indians, and they would do it without government permission, because the government was very controlling over who went in and went out of Indian territory. So Parley, when he got to Indian territory, he was incognito and they didn't know who he was. Again, thinking ahead, Parley had the sense enough to get a letter written, I think it was by Erastus Snow, that basically said that he was Parley Pratt, an apostle. So at that point, they then were able to keep him hidden away for quite a while as Eleanor starts making her way through Texas. Both are east of Fort Gibson, which is in Oklahoma. The U.S. Marshal captures, and he finds out first about Eleanor McLean, and she's with a group of non-Mormons, but he's still, the U.S. Marshal's still worried that, you know, he goes in there, he takes a woman with two children, who knows how people are going to react to that. He sends somebody back to get at Fort Gibson, the military. And so I think 16 or something like that, military men meet up and then they arrest Eleanor McLean. Mm-hmm. And at that point, Hector McLean shows up and then he gets the children. And I may have that reversed. But anyway, it's really complicated how all that. And so Pratt, Parley Pratt, is on his way and he makes it across the Arkansas River. The soldiers then see him and they pursue him and they arrested him. So they're both taken, both Eleanor McLean and Parley Pratt are taken into Fort Gibson. It's decided the only charge that McLean, I guess, was able to come up with was for stealing with Eleanor, because she had used that money to buy clothes and then abscammed. That's why she was arrested. Pratt, it was sort of weird. I'm not really sure why. But anyway, but they were able to do that. Oh, because he had, I guess because they said he had fled justice in St. Louis. And so he was arrested on the premise that the governor, you know, they were going to write the governor of Missouri and see where that all stood. And because these are civilians, obviously the military can't do anything with them. So they then are brought in by the U.S. Marshal, and I believe they had a military escort as well, brought into Van Buren, Arkansas, which is not that far from where Fort Gibson is in Oklahoma. Just a couple of days' ride, is my understanding. McLean is sort of in the shadows of this whole thing, okay? And he, the whole time he's telling, you know, everybody he can get to listen to him, again, and let me explain, though. We only have Eleanor McLean's account and then Samuel Binion, who was a mission president in Independence, Missouri during the turn of the century, gets information because he covers Arkansas. And okay, So he's getting stories that have been passed down. So that's all. So his are 1902, Pratt's killed in 1857. You know, that's almost 50 years later, you know. And now Eleanor is more contemporary. She wrote her account for the Church Historian's Office. That was the idea was they were going to publicize it. And so she gives hers, but again, she's probably not really the greatest witness against Hector McLean and giving, you know, accurate information. But that is really all we've got of all these events that are going on. There's one other one where one guy tells another guy that tells another guy, you know, 50 years later, that he was there and heard Parley Pratt's words. So again, all these, you know, we're getting all this kind of stuff through all these lenses of later. So Eleanor tells us that, she, you know, he's just going everywhere. Well, they treat Eleanor really, and this is again according to Eleanor, so you got to sort of believe she's at least telling this part accurately, because they take her into a really nice hotel, the women of the area bring her new dresses, and she's treated extremely well. This is in Van Buren, Arkansas. Parley Pratt's put directly in jail. Again, according to Eleanor, she goes before Judge Ogden, because that's who's going to, you know, try her for her stealing clothing, the money for the clothing, and Parley Pratt for leaving Missouri as a fugitive. Again, according to Eleanor, Ogden believed everything she told him, that Hector McLean was an abusive husband, and that Parley Pratt was just helping her the best he could to get out of a bad situation, and that he was there and saved her life, essentially. So Ogden dismissed the charges against Eleanor, and according to Eleanor, the next morning, Ogden then went to the jail where Parley Pratt was, offered to give him his gun. And again, Ogden was fearful that McLean would kill, because again, according to Eleanor, McLean was going around town in Van Buren claiming he was going to, you know, murder, well, not murder, he was going to avenge his wife's dignity and honor and whatever. And so he was going around telling everybody. Again, according to Eleanor, Ogden kept McLean in his office until 2 o'clock in the morning, where McLean told him, because Ogden said, you better keep your guys, because McLean had supposedly gotten his Masonic buddies, I guess it would be the local Masonic group, but he had riled them up to help him. And so McLean was doing that, and Ogden said, you'd better not let any of your guys take his life. And McLean said to Ogden that he did not wish any man to touch him, that was his privilege he wished to reserve for himself. Or that was a privilege he wished to reserve for himself. So according to Eleanor, he admitted that he wanted to murder Parley Pratt. Ogden goes and offers his pistol and knife. And skeptic Joe Geisner, I this was Eleanor McLean saying this. So here's what she claimed that Pratt said. Gentlemen, I do not rely upon weapons of that kind. My trust is in my God. Well, why did Parley Pratt not feel that way at Crooked River when he opened that guy's belly open and, you know, with the sickle and die? You know, the guy died. So anyway, so Pratt rode off quietly, and McLean, with his Masonic buddies, were monitoring what was going on at the jail. They told McLean what had happened, that Pratt had left. So Pratt was able to do a pretty good job for a few miles. And then somebody crossed, you know, probably coming the other way into Van Buren, sees Pratt, warns McLean's Masonic buddies, three people, a man named James Cornell, a person named Mr. Howell, who, and he's not the Gilligan's Island Mr. Howell, I would think. And then McLean himself were notified what road Pratt was on. And so they went rode the 12 miles where Pratt now was. And Pratt's still on his horse, still trying to elude these. The two friends or associates of McLean cut off Pratt's route on the road. And so Pratt had to go into a wooded area. They call it a thicket. And I've never been to Arkansas, but I'm guessing it's a lot like the trees that I remember seeing there in the east, which are really much smaller than our trees out here in the west. And so I'm guessing that's what and very thick, though. You know, those are really, really thick. So Pratt goes in there. McLean starts shooting at Pratt. And McLean's not, and you know, nobody's a good shot on a horse, unless you're in a Western movie. But nobody's a good shot on a horse. And so the bullets, well, except for Crazy Horse. Crazy Horse was known as an amazingly good shot on a horse. But anyway, he puts bullets through his saddle, or he shoots into his saddle. He puts bullets into the saddle, and they go through his coat. Bullets go through his coat. So it appears that McLean emptied his revolver or gun or rifle, whatever he had, he emptied it. And Pratt has still not been hit by any bullets. He's able to catch up with Pratt in this thicket. And McLean pulled him from the saddle. He pulled out a knife and he stabbed Parley Pratt 3 times in the chest. He walked away, leaving Pratt to bleed to death there, which Pratt does not. And McLean goes and gets a derringer from one of the people that probably either are following him or one of his friends or whatever. He comes back and he shoots Parley Pratt in the neck, and it ricocheted off of Parley Pratt's collarbone the way it went in. So McLean heads back with his Masonic buddies to Van Buren, again, according to Eleanor McLean. To show you how grisly, and this is the part I'm going to be reading from Givens and Groh, because I think they do such a good job in explaining this. So this is their words, not mine. The attack occurred near the home of a local blacksmith, Zeely Wynn, who witnessed McLean force Pratt into the thicket. Thinking Pratt dead, Wynn spent the next hour alerting his neighbors. When they finally approached, Pratt asked, "Sir, will you please give me a drink of water, for I am thirsty, and raise my head if you please." Pratt identified McLean as his murderer, stating that he accused me of taking his wife and children. "I did not do it. They were oppressed, and I did for them what I would do for any oppressed anywhere." Pratt stated that he had not known his other assailants. A crowd soon gathered, including the local justice of the peace, who asked more than once if he wanted a doctor, and he answered no, no, but asked for water, which I brought him. As the men consulted about sending for doctors, Pratt said, "I want no doctors, for I will be dead in a few minutes. In the final hour, Pratt's thoughts turned to his family. And I'm going to stop because that to me was the most powerful part. My heart breaks. And again, I'm no fan of what Pratt did, okay, and how that all happened with Eleanor McLean or Belinda Martin. But, and I'm not a fan of polygamy, but no person should have to go through what Parley Pratt went through. It breaks my heart to think about that and to think what he went through. And that's significant, John, because of the next step we'll talk about. But Pratt asked the people there that he said he had a gold pocket watch. He had some gold coins, and he wanted those all sent to his family. What ended up happening was because there needed to be a burial, funeral undertaker, coroner, all those things were paid by private. And so the horse was sold, the saddle was sold, and then the effects, personal effects, then were sold, and I guess the coins would have been used to pay. Never sent. If there was any leftover, according to Eleanor, there was, but if there was any leftover, that was not sent to Pratt's family. Pratt also wanted his body taken by a Mormon pioneer group back to Utah for him, and that also was not done. Pratt was buried there in Van Buren, and there's been actually attempts to dig up. And if I recall correctly, it's been a while. I didn't even think to look up that, but that they actually did, I think, dig up some bones and take them back. The problem is there's no way of knowing if those are Parley Pratt's bones or not.
Right.
As far as matter of fact, I guess some people think that there's no way they could be because the grave was too shallow and it would have been from a later burial.
So Joe, as far as you know, was Hector McLean ever prosecuted?
McLean was arrested. There was a trial. No one actually saw McLean stab nor shoot, except maybe for those few friends he had that were with him. And they all left after they were done. They left. And you know what? I don't think he was arrested. The more I think about it, he was not arrested. What they said was the court said, maybe it was a court of inquiry, whatever it was, said there was no witnesses, there was nobody to say who had done the murder, that it was left unsolved. The murder was left unsolved. McLean, again, according to Eleanor, McLean bragged about the fact that he had murdered Pratt. You know, who knows if he really did or not.
It is hard to know. We have to somewhat speculate, but, you know, and she gives this story of this really nice judge, but I also have to think, you know, he's a polygamist in the South, where Mormons aren't liked that much. I wonder if the community really even cared or wanted to serve his or solve his murder.
So here's how the Fort Smith Herald, now this is about a month or so after Pratt was murdered in May. I'm not sure exact date. It was May something, but he was murdered in May 1857. So this is the Fort Smith Herald. It says, one Mormon less, nine more widows. Alas for the Mormon prophet, if thou hast power to raise the dead, Parley, raise thyself. So that's from that. Now, Brigham Young, just a short time after that news, about 3 weeks after that news article, then he says to both Orson Pratt and Ezra Benson, he says, one more good man has gone to assist brothers Joseph and Hiram in another sphere. William Appleby, who's a really excellent diarist, and his diary is now available on the Church History Library website, in fact. He writes in his journal, or no, he writes to Brigham Young. I'm sorry, he writes to Brigham Young. He says, editors, priests, and people are rejoicing over the murder of Brother Parley. Their joy will be turned into mourning before long. 23rd of June, 1857, Woodruff writes, we also are informed that Elder Parley P. Pratt was murdered by McLean, who shot him in Arkansas. This was painful news to his family. The papers of the United States are filled with bitter revilings against us. The devil is exceedingly mad. The 25th of June, he writes, when in the president's office on the 23rd, President Young asked George A. Smith if it was not hard to acknowledge the hand of God in the death of Parley P. Pratt by a wicked man as McLean. Yet we will have to do it. Young's statement, that is just weird to me. I guess you could say, well, you know, Young thinks that if you're an apostle, you shouldn't be killed, but yet he'd seen Joseph Smith and Hiram Smith murdered. Not, you know, he didn't see it, but he knew about it and was there in the aftermath. But, you know, it's just so weird. It's just a weird statement. But anyway, it gets more weird, by the way, as we go on. So Wilford Woodruff's journal again, August 1st, 1857. I spent the day in the office mostly. I called upon Eleanor Pratt and got an account of the death and burial of Elder Parley P. Pratt, who was murdered by McLean. So this is Brigham Young writing to George Q. Cannon. The Eastern Mail arrived the 23rd, conducted by Farinaw's Little and Ephraim Hanks. The excitement concerning us seems rather on the increase in the United States. I regret exceedingly to hear of the death of Brother Parley, but the Lord's not my will be done. The day will come when the kingdom of God will be triumphant, and none will dare to raise their hand against those who bear his. Wilford Woodruff says, I opened my grapes this morning and spent the day in a missionary meeting. We blessed and set apart 52 missionaries and ordained 470s. President Young delivered an address and gave good instruction. He said that Parley P. Pratt's blood was spilt for adultery, meaning Parley Pratt's adultery now. Okay, because remember, he got in trouble over Martha or Elizabeth Brotherton. Belinda Pratt. I mean, it just keeps going on for, you know, and so, and then he marries, you know, Belinda Martson and Eleanor McLean or McLean, you know, are married women. I met in the evening with the board of Jordan Irrigation Company. So there's that. Now, this is the worst of all. And this is actually, you and I love censored stuff. We absolutely love it. Well, this entry is this May 1st, 1865 entry that Wilford Woodruff just writes about in his journal. is very interesting. It has Brigham Young's, in the minutes, the General Church minutes, it has Pratt's, or it has Brigham Young's lecture that he gave, talk, address. And it also has, you know, how, remember how in Selected Collections they took the, they put those big black things across, and so they censor part? Well, this is censored in those minutes. And the only reason we know it is because John Turner, so, and he had it in the review he did, and he had it in his book on Brigham Young. So that's the only reason we now know what's in that blacked out. But it says, President Brigham Young said, Brother Parley's blood was spilt. I was glad of it, for it paid the debt he owed, for he whored. He felt the law was made for the rest of the elders of Israel, but not for him. You know, when you got friends like that, man, you know, and what John Turner thinks, and there's a very good possibility that, that it's true. So here's what John writes. He goes, in addition to the dispute over unauthorized marriages, Young lambasted Pratt for his and John Taylor's failure to adhere to his directives during 1847 journey to the Salt Lake. Although Pratt came to accept Young's preeminent position among the apostles in 1847 and repeatedly displayed his loyalty to the church and its new president, Pratt's actions in the mid-1840s gnawed at Young. Upon learning of Pratt's murder, Young placed the slain apostle among Joseph and Hiram Smith in the growing ranks of Mormon martyrs. As Givens and Groh note, though, in 1856, Young observed that Pratt's blood was spilt as punishment for his earlier disputed marriages. The authors might have included the fuller version, which is the one I read. And then this is the thing that John observes. Young might forgive the perceived transgressions of his subordinates, but he never forgot them, and he did not mince words.
Okay, so Parley P. Pratt's, this is just an example of extra legal justice then, right? You have a scenario here where law is kind of arbitrary.
It absolutely is arbitrary, and we don't want to think about that or admit it, that the law is arbitrary, but it really is. Every time I'm in a jury trial, I worry about jury nullification. We make jurors promise that they'll follow the law, even if they don't agree with it. Jury nullification is the worry today, but the worry back then on the frontier was that the law just simply wouldn't be applied. In the case of Parley P. Pratt, who cares if you murder a Mormon? Big deal. There was no need to enforce the law because we don't care. In Utah, as we will later discuss, there were murders that Mormons didn't care about either. Who cares that it's a Mormon leader that killed someone because that person slept with his wife? We just don't care. This is the very arbitrary attitude that led to so much violence and lynchings. It was illegal, but those in power simply did not care. And in the case of the saints in Utah, because they were the ones in power, the violence that occurred, for good reasons in their eyes, that extra legal justice, was totally justified. The laws of God always trump the laws of man.
Okay, so we have a lot of this idea that the laws of God trump the laws of men. I see this today with Mormon fundamentalists. That's why, you know, this idea of polygamy being criminalized doesn't really matter because fundamentalists are going to live that anyway if they believe it. But it just makes me nervous. I'm sort of a control freak, and I like law and order and all these rules and reactions, even though the way, you know, law is taken into people's hands, it's so arbitrary. It makes me nervous.
Yeah, of course, and it should. I mean, that's the point of extra legal justice. It's outside the law. You've taken the law into your own hands.
You killed Charlie because he killed your friend, right?
That's right.
Well, it happens Charlie was a good friend of mine. So let's see if he can do that trick twice.
I'd let it drop, friend.
Me?
You. Hope you don't mind.
It always seems to take more than one, doesn't it?
It's because they're no good. Pick up your gun.
What?
You want to try again now? Pick up your gun.
Okay, well, now that we've got going on this, I want to tell one more story. I've talked about this on my own Facebook page, but This really is a great example of the complicated and inconsistent nature of the solve, especially after talking about Parley P. Pratt. Okay, I'm sitting here with my great pal, historian Craig Foster. Hi, Craig. Thanks for coming on.
Hi. Good to be here.
I'm really excited that you are here because you initially pointed me in the right direction for this podcast. You helped inspire this because you've written on extralegal justice.
Yes, I actually have. I published an article titled The Butler Murder of April 1869, a look at extralegal punishment in Utah, in which I discussed examples of Utahns who used forms of extralegal punishment. I began with the story of William Butler, who, I might add, was my great-grandfather. And so if there was a personal interest here that got me going. But he was an Irish convert who farmed outside of Ogden. While the Transcontinental Railroad was being built through Ogden, one of the men following the railroad, you know, there were all kinds of people, hangers-on, who would go and usually were around the hell on wheels. And this guy was just one of those. But he attacked one of Butler's wives, gravely injuring her with a hatchet and killing one of his daughters who had come to help her when the guy started attacking.
That's such a, like, when you send the article, it's very violent. I mean, the railroad worker comes in, had been stalking her for a while, and then came in with a hatchet and killed her kid right in front of her.
He did. It was a horrible thing that happened. And like you said, extremely violent. So the guy, there were a couple of other kids. They went running, screaming, yelling, and neighbors, of course, heard all of the ruckus and they came to help. So the guy had seriously injured the wife and killed one of the daughters. He took off running. The residents in the area, they chased the man, and William Butler eventually caught up to him. They fought, and the guy had produced a knife. He pulled a knife, and Butler started fighting with him, got the knife away from him, stabbed him. He thought he killed him. So he went back to some of the neighbors who were still searching. He said, I've got him. We fought. I think I killed him. They went back to where they had fought, and the guy wasn't there, but there was a trail of blood. So he had stabbed him enough that, you know, the guy was well on his way to dying. They caught up with him. Only one person had, you know how we have this idea that in the old West, everyone carried guns and all that. One guy had a gun because he had been out riding. He handed the pistol to William Butler, and he said, you know, make it sure, Butler, this is the last bullet. And William Butler just pointed the gun at the guy's head and shot him and killed him. He then went into Ogden and turned himself into the city marshal, who told him he had done the right thing and to go home and take care of his family. So from that point, I then, in the article, I discussed others who had taken the law into their own hands, and that includes Howard Egan being, you know, he was one of them that I mentioned.
I'm glad you brought him up because that's who I want to talk about today. We're going to sort of juxtapose his story with that of Parley Pratt's. But, you know, William Butler's story is a perfect example, too, of extralegal justice and how he followed the rules in the sense that he went and turned himself in and they assert it's justified. Howard Egan's case is a little different, which is why I think it's fascinating. But can you sort of break down the main characters in the story for Howard Egan so we don't get confused about who they are? Who was Howard Egan?
So Howard Egan, like William Butler, was actually born in Ireland, but he came at a fairly young age to Canada. And he was in Canada and then started working on a ship sailing, eventually made his way to Massachusetts, where he met his wife, Tamsin Parsley, and they married in Massachusetts. And both he and she were converted to the LDS Church, and they traveled to Nauvoo, where Egan was a businessman. He was a Nauvoo city policeman, later in Utah, an explorer, rancher, friend of Brigham Young's. So that's one. And then James Monroe was also a convert, and both of them eventually ended up in Utah, where, and I think we'll explain this a little bit more, but basically James Monroe seduced Tamsin partially, and she eventually ended up being pregnant. And from there, we get into the act of violence.
Okay, so this is kind of an interesting story because Howard Egan's a Mormon from Nauvoo days. James Monroe is a Mormon from Nauvoo days. Tamsin Parsley, she was Mormon as well. So mm-hmm. Howard Egan was 24 when he married Tamsin. She was 15 at the time in 1839 in Salem, Massachusetts. And then they both converted to Mormonism, and Howard would take more plural wives in Nauvoo, which shows that he was kind of high up with kinship and leadership in the church. And there's a quote that Joseph Smith would praise him, saying, "We never feared when Howard Egan was on guard," because Egan was a Nauvoo policeman and bodyguard of Smith's, like you mentioned.
Right. Yeah.
But he would leave Tamsin alone a lot because he was, you know, working for the church, and, you know, men often left their families to go get work and do things for the church. And so while he was gone, she strikes up a friendship with James Monroe, who was Joseph Smith's clerk and a school teacher. And the two developed an affair that resulted in a pregnancy throughout the years. And so, and remind me, when she gets pregnant, this is now more into the Utah period, right?
Yes, yes. It was in about 1851. About from what I understand, she got pregnant, and she had either just recently given birth to the child, or was shortly to give birth, because the child was born in 1851. So that gives you an idea of how long Howard Egan had been gone. He had been in California on a mission slash just a kind of a prolonged journey in behalf of the church. So he had been gone for a while. And then he returned in 1851. I'm going on memory here. I think the child had been born by that point, but just by a month or so, you know, a couple of months.
Did he return because he had heard about the pregnancy? Is that why?
Nope. He was just on his way back. Because he had been gone for a period of time. If I remember correctly, I think he was one of those involved with the Gold Rush mission. That Brigham Young had sent a group of men to pan and mine for gold to help fund some of the things that they were trying to do, since they had just were trying to settle Utah there. And so he was just returning because he had been gone for a while, and got to Utah and heard what had happened. So he made a beeline for his home, and Monroe heard about him going. And so basically, you know, when Monroe heard that Egan was on his way home after this prolonged journey, he wisely, you know, chose to get out of town. And in fact, he was trying to get out of the territory altogether, because he had a pretty good idea Egan would go after him. And he was hoping that if he was out of the territory, then Egan would give up and not follow him. But Howard Egan did follow Monroe and finally caught up with him close to the Utah border, where he had attached himself for a short time with a wagon train Monroe had. Egan, he came up and he found him. He explained that he was going to kill him, and indeed, He did kill him. He shot and killed him. And Egan was later brought to trial in which William W. Phelps and George A. Smith served as his defense counsel. And during the closing argument, Smith, you know, was explaining that Egan should be found innocent, should be let go, because, you know, any real man would have done what Egan did. And he said, quote, "In this territory, it is a principle of mountain common law that no man can seduce the wife of another without endangering his own life. The principle, the only one that beats and throbs through the heart of the entire inhabitants of this territory, is simply this: the man who seduces his neighbor's wife must die, and her nearest relative must kill him," end quote.
Yeah, that's fascinating. Juanita Brooks also recorded the event, which is retold by Edward Hogan. It said that Egan rode out with Monroe and the two had a chat, and this is what Hogan writes, quote, "When they stopped, Egan told Monroe that he had taken away his peace of mind forever and that Monroe had only 30 minutes to live, during which time he exhorted him to contrition and preparation for his change. When the 30 minutes had passed, Egan drew a pistol and shot the unarmed Monroe in the face on the right side of the nose just below the eye. Monroe died immediately. Egan mounted his horse, rode up to the rest of the company, and gave them his name and said, 'Gentlemen, I have killed the seducer of my wife.' He then put his hand to his breast and added, 'Vengeance is sweet to me.' He told them that what he had done in the name of the Lord, that Monroe had ruined his family and destroyed his peace on earth forever. He then blessed them, wished them a safe journey in the city, and rode off." Egan's family history notes that he did this, quote, "not for anger, but for justice, citing mountain law and mountain language as justification." And so, Craig, one of the reasons I brought you on is I wanted to explore this idea of mountain law. John Dinger and I referenced it at the beginning of this podcast, and I kind of like the name. It sounds kind of badass.
Well, mountain law, while being a badass name, actually, it expressed a belief that that was really prevalent in other parts of the country also. So actually, I've had a long-standing interest in extra-legal justice, and we'll have an article coming out shortly, tentatively titled "Death to Seducers," which gives examples of extra-legal justice against people who are guilty of rape, seduction, and other crimes of that nature. So the sentiment that seducers should die was expressed in different parts of the country during most of the 19th century. So let me give you some examples here. So Bertram Wyatt Brown, who wrote Honor and Violence in the Old South, explained, quote, "Nothing could arouse such fury in traditional societies and insult hurled against a man's household. To attack his wife, mother, or sister was to assault the man himself," end quote. And so seduction of a female family member was an attack on the man's and the family's honor. Quote, "Fierce retaliation was therefore mandatory when a daughter, wife, or mother had been dishonored," end quote. So retaliation was expected, and it was expected to be violent. And if a man did not retaliate, then the shame would be on that man. And while Wyatt Brown accurately described this culture of honor or culture of violence being a Southern thing, when it came to seduction, such sentiments extended well beyond the Old South. For example, during the infamous 1875 Beecher Tilton trial for adultery, in which Henry Ward Beecher had seduced the wife of his best friend, took trial for adultery, Tilton's lawyer thundered near the end of the trial, and he was giving his final summing up. He thundered, quote, "Let it be written on every door throughout the land, death and destruction to the seducer, end quote. And others expressed that same sentiment. The Daily Nashville Patriot stated in 1857, quote, death should be the inevitable penalty of seduction. If the law does not provide it, public opinion should, end quote. And then the Kiowa, Iowa Courier announced in 1859, quote, death to the seducer is and should be the unwritten law, higher and more certain than written codes, end quote. The Wheeling Register in West Virginia stated in 1880, quote, seduction should be punishable with death, end quote. And the St. Paul Daily Globe wrote in 1885 that, quote, he who slays a seducer shall be justified in the act, end quote. Those are just some examples that I have found in my research on extra legal justice, where the sentiment was that, okay, the law may have one thing, but human nature and justice that demands that it be another way. And so that was kind of an attitude that you found throughout the country.
Well, and I just encourage everyone to look up your article on William Butler, because it sent me down, you know, this rabbit hole, and it's so fascinating because, as you just said, this was the pervasive attitude. And what I found interesting about this case is that researcher Edward Hogan writes that something happened similarly to Egan early on. So I'm going to read to you what he writes. He says, several years earlier in 1842, Egan himself was almost killed in Nauvoo under similar circumstances. Ironically, the incident involved one of Monroe's aunts, Catherine Zephaniah Clausen's widow. A superior had instructed Nauvoo officer John D. Lee to take a few policemen with him and stake out Sister Clausen's house. Egan had been seen visiting Mrs. Clausen almost every night at about 10 o'clock, not leaving until about daylight the next morning. Lee was told to knock Egan down and castrate him. Furthermore, Lee need not to be too gentle with the man because everyone would be quite happy if Egan died. Lee, however, had been instructed to report any unusual orders he received to Joseph Smith. Unable to find the prophet, Lee talked to Hiram, who told Lee that he had been inspired to bring this matter to him. Hiram told him that Egan was, in fact, married to Catherine Clausen. Moreover, their marriage was a holy one that had been performed in accordance with a revelation given to Joseph, which Hiram explained to him. Lee found the doctrine of plural marriage to be in accordance with his interpretation of the scriptures and immediately accepted it. Lee relayed Hiram's message to the chief of police, and Egan remained undisturbed by the police. I just think that's so interesting, if true, that Egan almost was killed for, you know, sleeping with another woman, which is why he killed James Monroe.
Right. The irony there.
I know. It's so fascinating. So how did it end with Egan after you said the jury needed only 15 minutes to render a verdict of not guilty? There's no indication whether the verdict was based on the jurisdiction question or because the jury found the defense attorney's appeal to mountain common law compelling. The reaction to the verdict printed in the Desert News, however, probably reflected the feelings of most of the saints, including the jury. The news wrote that the jury's decision should, quote, prove a sufficient warning to all unchaste reprobates that they are not wanted in our community, end quote. Indeed, Monroe was demonized by the saints after his death, though even the most cursory reading of his diary shows him to be anything but a monster. And that's from Edward Hogan. So what final thoughts do you have about this, Craig?
Well, it's interesting. You can see some of these. Here we have in Utah this example, yet you can see the examples of those feelings throughout the country. We mentioned about the wanting to castrate Howard Egan as a form of punishment for having been sleeping with this other woman. And there are examples of that in the country, too, which I discuss in the article that will be coming out in a couple of months or so. What it shows to me is, and what I tried to emphasize in my article about the murder that took place in 1869, that Utah overall, believe it or not, was less violent than, you know, the surrounding territories, other places in the country. Nevertheless, we still had examples of this attitude and the way that they would take care of problems. The attitude in the 19th century was really quite libertarian in terms of, you know, you follow a certain rules, whether that's part of what the laws are or not. And so Utah just reflected the rest of American culture, perhaps not as strongly in some ways and more strongly in other ways, but the people here were pretty much the same as in other parts of the country in terms of attitudes toward justifiable extra legal punishment, or mountain law, as they like to call it.
Well, thank you so much, Craig, for coming on. I appreciate it.
You're welcome. I enjoyed it.
Okay, Dinger, that's kind of a wild story. What's your take on all of this?
Wild is underselling it. The whole episode is, to me, fascinating and terrifying. I mean, first and foremost, it shows women were property back then. And so this whole thing kind of sadly reads like a property dispute. But further, kind of as a prosecutor, it just would have been impossible to do your job in Utah, because the laws, again, just didn't matter. Because Egan was of a higher priesthood, because he had the status of being a polygamist, he really didn't face any rules. He was able to do what he wanted. So for Monroe, he didn't have the protection against someone who was considered higher, that person that had a higher priesthood. I think you sometimes see that in the communities that you work in, Lindsay. And it's kind of like the unwritten rules of baseball, right? Because they're unwritten, sometimes you don't know why you're getting drilled in the back with a 95-mile-an-hour fastball. You just know you did something wrong. But this is also terrifying in looking how easily Egan can justify the cold-blooded murder. Just minutes after the murder, he basically says, he didn't do this for vengeance, but it was for justice. This was done in the name of the Lord, etc., etc. And so the belief that what they were doing was what God would want them to do is honestly scary. And we're going to come back to the effects of this trial and what it did to Utah and the history of the West in a later episode. But it caused ripples everywhere. The judge at this trial also put jurors into an impossible situation. He told them to either find him guilty by upholding federal law, which means, you know, the church doesn't have any power here, or find him not guilty because of mountain law, showing that it's the saints in power here in the territory of Utah. And so it's no wonder it took them 15 minutes to acquit. In fact, I'm surprised it took them that long. They must have taken a lunch break or something.
And we're back to that word mountain law again that we mentioned at the very beginning of this episode. It's such an interesting phrase. So you're right, Dinger. There you go. No need for zombies and lawless post-apocalyptic pandemics or whatever to understand this. Human behavior isn't that complicated. And you can learn a lot from just these two stories and throw in a little bit of religious context and it gets even wilder.
Yeah, but we really need to keep digging deeper. I mean, this is just a sample, just a small sample. I think there's a lot to be said about what extra legal cases in Mormonism can tell us about the larger story of Mormonism and humans in general.
Perfect. Okay, let's do it. But for that, obviously, we're going to need to do more episodes.
We've teased you, but now it's here. On the next episode, podcast miniseries Crime and Punishment, we're going to finally talk about the murder of Dr. Robinson.
Sunstone depends on your generous support. Please sign up for a recurring donation at sunstone.org and support this and many other projects.